We are inching our way through Mark's first century biography of Jesus of Nazareth. In context, we just finished, you remember last week, Jesus was teaching all day long on the side of the Sea of Galilee in a boat, and we pick up the story in Mark chapter 4, verse 35. Are you ready? Charlie, you? All right, absolutely. Here we go. That day, when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. I think that's funny. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." The setting for this story is the Sea of Galilee, which is actually a lake on the north side of Israel. It's 7 miles wide, 13 miles long, and it's located in a basin 700 feet below sea level with mountains on both sides. But the mountains on the east in particular skyrocket up. Mount Hermon, for example, which is not far away, is 9,200 feet above sea level. And the interchange between the warm lower air rising up from the Sea of Galilee and the cold upper air falling down from Mount Hermon does a number on the weather patterns. A ferocious, violent storm can come up out of nowhere and torment the lake. To this day, on the western side of the lake, there are warning signs in all of the parking lots. Because you can, true story, park your car on a bright, sunny Galilean day, walk into a restaurant for lunch, and come out an hour later to watch your car float off into the surf. It's dangerous, and it's really unexpected. And keep in mind that the Jews were not a seafaring people. They were 12 Bedouin tribes from the desert who found a home in Israel on the coast in the Mediterranean. But they were scared to death of the water and in particular of the sea. Here's why. In the ancient Near East, the sea was symbolic for evil and chaos and all the demonic powers raging against the Creator God. I think of Genesis 1 and how from the primordial waters of chaos, God created order. I think of Psalm 93, which is fascinating to me. It's a poem right in the middle of the Hebrew Scriptures. Yahweh reigns. He is robed in majesty. The Lord is robed in majesty and armed with strength. Indeed, the world is established, firm and secure. Your throne was established long ago. You are from all eternity. All right, it's the poet's way of saying Yahweh is king over all creation. But then listen, the seas have lifted up, Lord. The seas have lifted up their voice. The seas have lifted up their pounding waves. Mightier than the thunder of the great waters, mightier than the breakers of the sea, Yahweh on high is mighty. This is a poem with Yahweh set over against the waters of the sea. It's Yahweh's rule, which is marked by order, set over against chaos. And the point of the poet is that, listen, Yahweh is king over all creation. Yahweh has power even over the seas. I think of Daniel, the prophet's vision. You know the book of Daniel? It's an apocalyptic, crazy genre of literature. I think of his vision of four beasts, symbolic for four pagan empires, coming up out of the, anybody know? The sea. And then last, I think of John the Revelator and the closing image of the scriptures speaking about resurrection and the new heavens and the new earth. He says, there was no more what? Sea. All you surfers are like, I know, I'm super bummed, bro. Like, I know. Now, the point of that is not that there's no more ocean. It's that there's no more evil, no more chaos and anarchy and disorder, no more demonic powers and spirits raging against God's rule over the earth. To the ancient Jew, if you can immerse your imagination in this story, to the ancient Jew, the sea was not a place to go on vacation. The sea was the place where God and evil clash. The sea is the border between order and chaos. The sea is the dwelling place of the demonic powers. The sea is the place where monsters come from. And the sea is a daily reminder that we live in a world under Satan's sway. I mean, to this day, thousands of years later, I was in Israel not long ago, and they don't go into the water. I mean, I was on the beach. It's the Mediterranean, picturesque aquamarine waters, white sandy beaches, hot. Imagine the French Riviera. Not that I would know, but I have Google, all right? I mean, it's like that. It's absolutely fantastic. There were two people in the water both times that I was at the ocean. No, you're at a resort. Nobody goes into the water. There is, thousands of years later, ingrained into the culture for people in that part of the world, a deep subconscious, if not conscious, fear of the water. So all that to say, this is a story about a storm, but it's a story about so much more. Let's work through the text one sentence at a time. 35, that day, or at the end of a long day of teaching, when evening came, it's getting dark, he said to his disciples, hey, let's go over to the other side. Now, the other side was a region called the Decapolis. We'll talk more about the Decapolis next week. For now, just know that Jesus is crossing over from Jewish territory, kind of the land of Abraham and Isaac and Yahweh's temple, into Gentile territory. In Jewish imagination, the land of demons and spirits and the Roman imperial army and all of that. He's crossing over. It's a dark and scary place to go. 36, leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. Remember, Jesus is already in the boat teaching. He used the water as a natural sound system and the embankment on the shore as a natural amphitheater. He's already in the boat. And after he's done teaching, hey, it's getting dark. Hey, everybody, have a great day. They pull up anchor and head off. There were also other boats with him. He's not alone. A furious squall, 37, came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. The phrase furious squall in Greek can be translated hurricane. The waves are crashing over the side. The boat is filling up with water and about to capsize. And keep in mind that it's a boat, not a ship. All right, in 1986, a boat from around the time of Jesus was found in the mud in the north part of Galilee, about 5 miles from Capernaum, Jesus' hometown. Here's a cruddy pic from a museum that I was in. The boat is 26 feet long, 7 feet wide, and 4 feet deep, and was powered by one sail and about four people on oars. I think we have another kind of cruddy picture. And it would seat about 15 men at the most. So all that to say, you do not want to face a hurricane in this. Am I right? I mean, it's just not what you're up for, which is why, 38, Jesus was in the stern sleeping on a cushion, because that's what you do, right? In the middle of a hurricane, you take a nap. I mean, you get a little bit of shut-eye. And there's on the front part of the boat, there was a sandbag used for ballast, and Jesus is up there napping. He's asleep in the front of the boat. Now, this says so much. I mean, in part, it just says that Jesus was tired. After a long, hard day of teaching, I can only imagine. My fuel band says that I burn the exact same amount of calories in one teaching as I do on a 5 mile run. All right? True story. Which means by the end of Sunday, four or five teachings in, I'm catatonic. There's nothing left but grouchy pants. That's all. All right? And I can only imagine Jesus, after teaching all day long out in the hot Palestinian sun, no microphone, on a moving platform. I can only imagine he's dead tired and he's asleep. But this is about way more than that. Way more than about way more than the fact that Jesus was human and he was tired, like you and I get tired. This was about Jesus' trust in God. This is a sign of the fact that Jesus was at peace. At rest, he was calm and relaxed. He was not stressed out and up in arms. No, Jesus, this is about Jesus' trust in God to take care of him. Now, the disciples, on the other hand, are freaking out. The disciples woke up, the text says, and said to him, "Teacher, Rabbi, don't you care if we drown?" They are rude, as people often are in a crisis, right? When you're in a, I can only imagine, a hurricane, manners are not at the top of your list, right? Hey, don't you care if we drown? We're about to die. Where are you? You're asleep. What is wrong with you? Don't you care? And he got up, 39, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, shut up. And that's basically, that's one way to translate it. Shut up, be quiet, sit down, shut up, no more. Stop. Hurricane. And it's fascinating. Now here, here's what's intriguing to me. The language used right here is the exact same language used in Mark 1 for Jesus casting out a demon. Remember that story right in the beginning when Jesus in the synagogue, opening day, there's a demonized man, and the text says in Mark 1, Jesus rebuked the demon and said, quiet, come out of him. Then not long afterwards in Mark 4, Jesus says the exact same thing, not to a demonized man, but to the storm. He rebuked the storm and he said, quiet, be still. And in Greek, it's in the second person singular. If you're an English teacher, you know what that means. If you're like me, you have to look it up. It means, it's like Jesus is talking to a person as if to say, the exact same kind of demonic power that was at the back of the man in the synagogue was at the back of the storm on the lake. Fascinating to me. Tangent, not really, it's from the text, but kind of. You know, it seems like every time there's a natural disaster, a hurricane or a tsunami or an earthquake or a whatever, that some fool comes from a certain segment of the church, God bless him, comes on national television or his blog that 10 people read or radio or whatever and says, hey, listen, this was the will of God. And then they drop churchy language like God's sovereign, God's in control, a phrase that you know well, I hate. It's nowhere to be found anywhere in the scriptures, and I would argue it's wrong, even though it's used by almost every single follower of Jesus I know. It's wrong. God's in control? To which people, not only people who aren't followers of Jesus, people like me think, really? God's in control of that. Innocent people died. You're telling me God's in control? Well, that begs the question, what kind of God is in control of that? Your God is in control? People died? What kind of God is in control of that? Now, in stark contrast to that kind of language that's popular, at least in America, Jesus, on the other hand, rebuked the storm and said, shut up, stop, and it was over. Jesus did not say, hey, guys, just trust in the Lord. God has a plan. When God opens a door, closes a door, he opens a window. Right? No, that's not what he said. Right? Hey, God has a plan. Just trust him. You don't understand. I don't understand. Just trust him. I know God has a plan here. Does Jesus say that? No, he's mad. He rebuked the storm, said, quiet, settle down, and stop right now. Yes, it is true that a natural disaster can be from the hand of God. Whether I like it or not, that's a reality. We see that in the Old Testament, specifically in the story of the Exodus. But it's also true, if not more so, and I would argue far more probable, that a natural disaster can be from a demonic power, like right here in the story. If I'm going to blame anybody, if I'm going to default to blame anybody, it's not God that I worship in Jesus, it's that. And it's also true that a natural disaster can be the result of just the plain and simple fact that we live in a post-Genesis 3 world. I mean, I grew up in California, right? And I lived a mile from the San Andreas fault line. And I lived through the 1989 earthquake. It was just a vivid memory growing up. It was just crazy. And the entire city I lived in, the entire downtown corridor was absolutely wrecked. My friend's house, I was a wealthy friend and had this beautiful kind of mansion up in the hills, even closer to the fault line. And his entire house slid off the foundation and crashed in the bottom of a ravine. By the grace of God, he was not in it, right? Nobody was injured. It was empty. I remember that vivid. I remember going to his house, pulling into his driveway. There's no house there, peering over the edge, and the house is down at the bottom. It's just crazy. So maybe that was from the hand of God. Probably not, but maybe. Maybe that was from a demonic power. I would guess that far forward. Or maybe it was just because my buddy built a house a mile from the San Andreas fault line, and you shouldn't do that. Like, that's more than enough reason in my mind. All that to say, Jesus does not default to, hey, trust God, I know there's a reason you don't. He defaults to, shut up, stop, knock it off, calm down. He rebuked the storm. And watch what happens. Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. Right? In the NIV, it says there was a furious squall and then it was completely calm. But in Greek, there's actually a play on words using the Greek word mega, which means, can you imagine what that means? Like, yeah, great, right? Think of like Megatron or whatever, right? Mega something, right? Mega means great. And so in Greek, it says there was a mega storm and then there was a mega calm. Oh, it's incredible. The water is glass. And then 40, he turned around and said to his disciples, why are you so afraid? That word, Jesus right here, the question becomes the questioner, right? He's like, okay, now it's my turn. And why are you so afraid is the first question. That word afraid is a pejorative in Greek. It's a, it doesn't mean scared. It means cowardly. It means you are the kind of person who is scared all the time. Why are you so afraid? Why are you so cowardly in your character and the way you are wired? Do you still have no faith after all we have been through? I mean, you've been with me for months now, miracle after miracle, healing after healing, exorcism after exorcism, teaching after teaching. I just finished an hour ago a teaching about how the kingdom of God is an unstoppable force, how God's spirit is relentless in the world and nothing can hold back the inbreaking of God's rule over the world through my life. I just finished that an hour ago. What were you doing? Sleeping? Right? What were you doing? Do you still, after all we have been through, do you still have no faith? The questioned becomes the questioner. And then they, 41, were terrified. Now that is an even more graphic and vivid word than they were scared. They were terrified. First they are scared of the hurricane, and then they are terrified of the rabbi with power over the hurricane. And the closing question, it's provocative in Mark's story, and this is what Mark wants you to walk away with, is this. Who is this? Even the wind and waves obey him. That can be translated, even the wind and the waves are at his beck and call. Now, Mark is a brilliant writer, and as with any good author, there are layers of meaning to the story, one after another. Here's two or three if you're taking notes. First off, let's start with the obvious kind of axiomatic one. The first layer is that Jesus is more than a rabbi. He is the embodiment of the Creator God. Jesus was a well-known rabbi, or a word meaning teacher. He was well known all over Israel. I mean, thousands of people would come from up and down Palestine to listen to Jesus teach. So much so, there by Mark 4, and we're not even that far into the story, there's no more room in the synagogue, much less the house. There's no more room in town. He has to go out to the desert, up to a mountain, out to an amphitheater on the side of a lake, out to a boat because there's no room on the beach. I mean, people from all over hanging on Jesus every word. Now, remember that the opening line in Mark's gospel is, quote, the beginning of the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the what? Anybody know? Flip over. It's like two pages away. The Messiah, the what?
Son of God.
Son of God. Thank you. Somebody was paying attention a few months ago. The Messiah, the Son of God. Now, this is interesting. In scholarship, it's called the Messianic Secret Motif. It's a literary device used all through Mark, and it's genius stuff. Because you, the reader, you know right from the get-go, from the opening line, you know Jesus' identity. You know, who is this? You know Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. But the disciples are clueless. Peter, James, John, the guys that later are the authors of the New Testament, right now at this point in the story are clueless, have no idea. They think Jesus is just a rabbi, for sure with God's power living in some strange enigmatic way in and through Jesus, absolutely. But they just think of Jesus as Jesus of Nazareth, the rabbi with a strange power from God. They don't quite yet get the gravity of Jesus' identity. And so they ask, you know, teacher, rabbi, don't you care for drowning? And then after the storm, it's, oh my gosh, who is this? And here's why. In the Hebrew scriptures, only God, only Yahweh, the creator, has power over the seas. For example, here's one of many, Psalm 107. Some went out to the sea in ships. There were merchants on the mighty waters. They saw the works of Yahweh, his wonderful deeds in the deep, for he spoke and stirred up a tempest or a storm that lifted high the waves. They mounted up to the heavens, the sailors, and went down to the depths. In their peril, their courage melted away. For some reason, I'm thinking of George Clooney right now in The Perfect Storm. They reeled and staggered like drunkards. They were at their wits' end. Then they cried out to Yahweh in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed. Wow, there's nothing like poetry. Is that about a storm? Or is that about life? I'm not quite sure. Or I think of Isaiah, the prophet. Awake, awake, arm of the Lord. Clothe yourself with strength. Awake as in days gone by, as in generations of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces and pierced the monster through? Rahab was an ancient name for a demonic being. And where is the demonic being? Next line. Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made a road in the depths of the sea, think of the Exodus, so that the redeemed might cross over? That's two examples out of dozens. Point being, God, Yahweh, is the one and only being in the cosmos with power over the waters of the sea, with power over creation itself. But in Mark's story, Jesus has power over the sea. Wow. Meaning the power that made the world in the beginning, that brought the earth out of the primordial oceans of chaos, that power, should I say that person, is living in Jesus. Over and over again in Mark, Jesus does what only God can do. People say Jesus never claimed to be God. First off, that's not true. Read the Gospels. Secondly, even if it was, even if we did not have one teaching from Jesus, one sentence out of Jesus' mouth, if all we had were the stories in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and an extra biblical historical records about Jesus, if all we had were the stories, they are stories about Jesus doing God stuff. Jesus doing stuff that only God can do. I'm sick and tired, with all due respect to my city that I love, of the Jesus was a nice teacher and nothing more mindset. It's just not true. Have you never read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Have you never read Jesus' teachings? Have you never read the stories about Jesus? They are stories about God at work in and through a rabbi from Nazareth. If Jesus was just a nice teacher, then Jimi Hendrix was just a nice kid with a guitar. The Jesus that we are following is way more. He is the embodiment of the Creator God. And that is why, just to remind you, that is why we're in Mark week after week after week. You all know this story, but that's why we're here in the Gospels on a regular basis, because in Jesus, we see what God is like. Keep in mind that when you read a story about Jesus, you are reading a story about who? God, or more specifically, about what God is like. When you read a story about how Jesus treats tax collectors and prostitutes, you learn, okay, that's how God feels towards sinners. And it's very different from how the American church feels towards sinners. When you read a story about how Jesus treats the sick, men and women with Hansen's disease, or blind, or lame, or cripple, you learn, okay, that's how Jesus feels toward the handicapped. That's how Jesus feels toward children with Down syndrome. That's how Jesus feels toward the Dalit in India. That's how Jesus feels toward the people that our society, our evolved society, thousands of years later says, nah, you're not fit to live. That's how God feels towards the people that are cut off. When you read a story about how Jesus gets frustrated with the disciples because they still don't believe, with all due respect, that's how Jesus feels towards me and you too. When after all we have been through with God, we still freak out. And we still don't have faith. Because this is a story about Jesus, but more, this is a story about what God is like. It's not so much that Jesus is God, he is, but it's more like God is Jesus. meaning God is like Jesus. God always has been like Jesus. There was never a time when God was not like Jesus, and God always will be like Jesus, because at the center of all reality in the universe is Jesus of Nazareth, the ultimate self-expression of the Creator God. That, my friends, is why we have to stay rooted in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four first century biographies of Jesus, because it's on these pages that we see Jesus, and in Jesus that we see God. That's why we're calling you 7 days a week, 365 days a year, no matter how busy you are, no matter what time you have to be at work, we're calling you every day to read from the Gospels. A story, a paragraph, an entire Gospel in one sitting, whatever your style is, we're calling you to read every single day and pray two things: Jesus, show me who you are, and Jesus, show me what you are like. Because in Jesus, on these pages, we see God. This rabbi is more than a rabbi. Now, secondly, that's the obvious one, all right, on the surface. Secondly, underneath that is another well-known layer to the story, and it's this, if you're taking notes, that Jesus is with you when your boat is about to go under and you are freaking out. Would you agree? That's the point of the story. Remember that Mark was written a few decades after Jesus, as far as we know, to followers of Jesus in the city of Rome, facing persecution, prison, torture, and death, all at the hands of a crazy, demonized, sadistic Hitler-type figure named Caesar Nero. And the disciples in Mark's day, no doubt, are freaking out. And Mark is drawing a parallel. He wants the followers of Jesus in Rome, decades later, to see the parallel between the disciples on the Sea of Galilee and their life decades later in Rome. Mark is saying that, listen, Jesus, contrary to what you might feel — and feelings are deceptive, am I right? — contrary to what you might feel, Jesus is not far off or aloof or indifferent or uncaring or numb to your pain or your fear or your worry or your suffering. But Jesus is a few feet away, asleep on a cushion. Jesus, meaning, is with you from beginning to end. And this story is Mark's invitation to his readers, ancient and modern. Listen, when you're in a storm, go ahead, wake Jesus up. Pray to Jesus, freak out, that's okay. Vent all of your fear and doubt and anger and hyperventilate, that's fine. Just don't be surprised when Jesus says, quiet, be still. And then he turns around and says, do you still have no faith? Just don't be surprised. That's what Jesus, that's what God is like. After all, this is a story about the contrast between fear and faith. Evil and chaos often hit us out of the blue, am I right? Just like storms on the Sea of Galilee. I mean, overnight, with a phone call, with an email, with a text message, the betrayal, the loss, the death of a loved one, the car accident. Think of somebody who was here last hour whose daughter was hit head-on in a car accident 2 weeks ago. I think of the Frasers. I think some of you are down here. Yeah, I think of Eric Fraser, 27 years old. A bunch of you know Eric. Amazing guy. Been around the church from the beginning. 27, healthy, great shape, runner, getting ready for Hood to Coast. Just started a great new job. Two kids, infant daughter. 6 weeks ago? How long ago? 8 weeks ago? Something like that. Seizure late at night. Rushed to the hospital and found a massive tumor on his brain. Surgery a few days later. I mean, just out of the blue, I mean, your whole life is turned upside down. We're praying for you guys. We're rooting for you in a huge way. We love you guys. And that's what life can be like that. Am I right? Not always. Not all of you will live through something like that. But life can be like that when evil and chaos hit us out of the blue. And if you're anything like me, then in a storm, you do two things. First, you freak out, right? Anxiety and fear and worry flood your thinking and your feeling. And I've been honest with you, you know that anxiety is a deficiency in the way I'm wired. In fact, anxiety is not the right word. I hate that word because worry is the word used in the scriptures. Anxiety makes me sound like a victim. Worry makes me sound like a guy who needs Jesus. The latter is far more correct. And worry is seriously, if you know me at all, a deficiency in my character. It's an area that God is at work and I need to shore up with the help of the Spirit in my life. And I'm like that. I my mind, my thinking, my feeling is out of control and I freak out. And then secondly, I question God's love. Don't you care if I drown? You ever like that? Don't you care, God, if I'm out of work? Don't you care if my marriage is not all that I hoped it would be, if not falling apart at the seams? Don't you care about my health? Don't you care about the ruling in court? Don't you care, God, where are you? Why are you asleep? It's like you don't care. It's like you're not paying attention. You ever feel like that? We freak out. We question God's heart. This story is an invitation to trust. Just like Jesus, asleep, right in the front of the boat, right in the middle of the storm, he's asleep. Trust in God, peace, rest, shalom. And this story is an invitation for you and I to do the same. And keep in mind that our trust or our faith is not so much in a God who will deliver us from storms, right? His disciples right here, he leads his disciples right into one. God does that, you know. But our faith rather is in a God who's with us in storms and has power over everything in the created order. That's what our faith is in. You see, in a storm, in life in general, we question God, right? Don't you care if I'm drowning? Don't you care if I'm unemployed? Don't you care if you fill in the blank? But at the same time, God questions us. Do you still not believe? After all we've been through, do you still have no faith? And Mark's invitation is to turn from questioning God to answering God's question. And to have faith in God, to remember that. If you're in a storm right now, gosh, we are with you as your family. I'm not. I'm doing well. I just finished vacation. But if you are, and I know there are a ton of you who are, or if you will be, or should I say, when you will be in the future, remember to have faith in God. And remember more than anything that God is with you. You know, one of the last things I went through that was really challenging, and it might sound trite to you, but for me and my wife, it was a huge deal, was when we adopted our daughter. She's been home for a year now. We were just looking at pictures of her last year at vacation, and this year it's crazy. She grew 7 inches, like eating me out of house and home. And like any good girl, she has a whole new wardrobe in a year. She doesn't fit any of her clothes anymore. That experience of being in Uganda was crazy. It was one of the worst experiences in my life, just emotionally, what it was for my wife and I. And, you know, you're there. My wife was there for 6 weeks, and you're falling in love with this little girl who's scared to death of you. That's a whole other story. And you're bonding with her, but technically she's not your daughter. She's a cute Ugandan that you hang out with. She's not technically your daughter until all the legal work is done on the last day before you head out of the country. And about halfway through, things started to kind of unravel. The court system is volatile, as you can imagine, and it started to look like we were not going to be able to adopt her and fly home on a plane empty-handed and brokenhearted. And I can't put into words. It was like emotional torture. And I remember reading the scriptures every day, reading the gospels as I do, and I remember reading this story while I was in Uganda. And I remember just that sense of God saying, I'm with you. Not God saying, hey, it's all going to work out. God didn't say that, the punk. I mean, it did. Sorry, I just called God. That's not right. 4 weeks off and I'm a pagan already. My goodness. But God did not say, hey, it's all going to work out, John Mark. And in the end, by God's grace, it did. All God said to me in the moment was, I'm with you. I'm with you. And sometimes that's all you need to hear, right? It's the one thing you can put your foot on, the fact that God is with you. So remember that, whether you're in a storm now or whether that's a month away, a year away, a decade away, remember that God is with you. Now, last, there's one more layer of meaning underneath all of that that you may or may not know about. And it's this, that Jesus is a greater than Jonah. Now, stay with me for a minute. With good authors and good books, there are often allusions to other authors and other books. For example, on vacation, I read fluff, okay? And I read don't judge me. If you do, I don't care. I read a novel by Tim Powers called The Claire, and it's a great genre. It was kind of like World War II, Cold War, Soviet era, like spy thriller mixed with like a supernatural kind of really scary genre, which is great fun to read. And the whole book was set over against the backdrop of the Bible in particular, but Job specifically. And there are all these allusions all the way through the novel to the book of Job. Now, none of them are overt. I mean, there's a few, like the titles from a verse in Job at the beginning, but none of them are overt. You have to know the Bible and you have to know Job to get it. But because I know the Bible, kind of, and I know Job, then as I was reading, it was so much fun because you read a line, you're like, oh my God, that's a quote. I know that line. I know that. Oh my gosh, this is an allusion to that. Oh, he's saying this. Oh, that is so good, right? But you have to be an insider to get it. Well, in the same way, the entire story right here is set over against the story of Jonah in the Hebrew scriptures in a way that if you were Jewish, you would know. Now, imagine you're in the church that Mark is reading to, and you're a Jew. Maybe you're the minority. Maybe it's half and half. I don't know. And somebody up front is reading Mark out loud in one sitting, and you get to this part, and you notice the language. You notice the hint, the echo, the quote, and you lean over to your Gentile buddy and say, you have no idea. He's quoting from Jonah right now. This is like a whole thing, you wouldn't get it. You're a Gentile, but trust me, it's awesome, right? And that's what's going on here in the story. So language is used all through the story that's straight out of Jonah. The word die, for example, is the exact same verb used of Jonah. The phrase died down is the exact same phrase used for the storm in Jonah. And the closing frame, this is like the red light on the dashboard blinking kind of hint. The closing phrase, they were terrified in 41, is an interpretive gloss. In Greek, it is awkward. It's not the way that Greek language works because it's a translation of a Hebrew phrase that's called a double imperative. You don't need to know that. There's no test at the end. But Hebrew is a clunky language. My Hebrew prof calls it caveman speak. And there's not a ton of adjectives in the Hebrew language. So if you want to really emphasize something, you say it twice. So there's no way to say, you know, they were terrified in Hebrew. Instead, you say it this way. They feared a fear. How awesome is that? It's caveman talk. They feared a fear. And that's what this is right here in this language. It doesn't actually say they were terrified. It actually would make no sense to you and I, but it actually says they feared a fear. And that is a well-known line right in the middle of the Jonah story that any Jew would have known, where the sailors are scared to death in the storm, and it says they feared a fear. So this entire story is a compare and contrast between Jonah and Jesus. They are similar and dissimilar. Similar in that both are prophets. Both are prophets on the way to Gentiles, Jonah to Nineveh and Jesus to the Decapolis. Both are in a storm. Both sleep through the storm. Both are woken up by sailors who are scared to death. Both stop the storm, Jonah through attempted suicide, and Jesus through his power over creation itself. But they are dissimilar in a gigantic way. Jonah is running away from God's call. Jesus, on the other hand, is running to face God's call head on. Mark's point is that Jesus is, in Jesus' own language, a greater than Jonah, end quote. Meaning instead of running away from God's call because his heart was numb and indifferent to the pain and suffering in the world, Jesus, unlike Jonah, is running to face God's call head on, bleeding with love for the world. And he's running right to preach against evil and chaos and the demonic powers at the back of the world. And he's running right into battle with the sea itself. And this defeat on the Lake of Galilee in Mark 4 is just one blow. The decisive victory is yet to come when Jesus on the cross will take Satan and the demonic powers of death head on. And he will not jump overboard. He will not abandon ship. He will not grab a life preserver. He will stay through and take the full weight of evil on his shoulders. And through his death and resurrection, he will break the grip of evil's power on the world, and he will usher in a calm like glass over all of the universe once and for all. And because of that, because of Jesus' life and death and resurrection, you and I have nothing to fear but God himself. Am I right? Nothing to fear but God himself. And as it's been said, if you fear God, there is nothing else to fear. Because the worst thing that evil can throw at you, the final weapon in its armada, is death. But Jesus beat evil and personified evil and Satan and his demonic beings through his death. And Jesus beat death itself through his resurrection. And because of that, the worst thing that can ever happen to you is you die and one day you come out the other side in the resurrection. I was with my grandpa who was here this morning up from California, and he's dying right now. He's good, he's healthy, but doctors gave him a few years to live. We're hoping it's longer than that. And this just does something to a man. We're talking about Alaska. He's going up to Alaska, even as he's, how old is he? How old is grandpa? 80-something? He's going to Alaska tomorrow. Crazy guy. I love him. He's absolutely my hero. And I was talking about my dream to take a motorcycle trip up to Alaska one day. And he's like, oh, I wish I could do it with you. You know, he's strong. He's just old school, like strong. Lives up in the mountains in California. And I said, you know what? We'll do it one day. Probably on the other side of resurrection. But Alaska's not going anywhere, Grandpa. It's going to get nothing but better. And if we have motorcycles now, I'm sure we will have them in the age to come, right? I'm just absolutely positive. I know it's not in the scriptures, but it might as well be, right? Like, you have that hope in you. Worst thing that can happen, resurrection's on the other side. So if you're in a storm, and it's easy to sound trite right now, I'm not doing well. But on a serious note, if you're in a storm right now, if your boat is filling up with water, if your faith is put to the test right now, or if not, but you know that you will be in a month or a year or a decade or whenever, you have no idea. Just remember, whatever happens, don't forget that God is with you. Believe that. No matter how many storms you go through, it's deja vu, right? It's like a different storm, but the same God. That's life. Life is not easy. It's a cheap trick to say, hey, come to Jesus and your life will be awesome. It's gospel to say, follow Jesus and he will be with you no matter what you are up against. Just don't forget that. This morning, right here, right now, and no matter what you go through, whether it's a decade away or God is with you and he has power over the sea. Have faith in God. Let's pray. God, thank you for your faithfulness to myself, my family, and friends. Thank you that you are a God, not a God who's aloof and distant and far away, but you are a God who is close by, who is near. You're with us right now this morning. In particular, you are with those who are in pain. And I pray that you would make your presence known right now as we worship, as we engage you, as we just take a deep breath and think about you and meditate on you and kind of let the text sink in and listen to the Spirit of God. I pray that you, in a special and unique, in a profound way, would make your presence known as we worship you. Amen.